When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. In 1934, tens of thousands of communist guerrillas flee Jiangxi and extended retreat through hazardous terrain to Shanxi in the north, while under fire from their nationalist enemies. The Long March, as it became to be known, helped build the legend of the Chinese Communist Party and of its leader, Mao. While on the Long March, Mao has a daughter who was left behind to live with a local family due to the trek's dangers. That event inspired Michael X. Wong's debut novel, Lost in the Long March, about one couple who faced a similar decision whether to leave their child behind, and that decision's repercussions decades later. Michael was born in Fengyang, a small coal mining city in China's mountainous Shanxi province. His short story collection, Further News of Defeat, won the 2021 Penn Robert W. Bingham Prize for Debut Short Story Collection and was a finalist for a 2021 CLMP Firecracker Award for Fiction. Michael's work has appeared in the New England Review, Greensboro Review, Day One, and Juked, among others. He is currently as a professor of English and Creative Writing at Arkansas Tech University and lives in Russellville, Arkansas. Today, Michael and I talk about The Long March, what makes it a great setting for a novel, and how its story aligns with many other family stories from modern China. So, Michael, you know, thank you for coming on the show to talk about Lost in the Long March. The Long March is this big historical event in China. It's like a big turning point for modern Chinese history, for the history of the Communist Party of China, for the history of kind of Mao Zedong. But what was it about the Long March to make it the setting for your novel?
Thank you so much, Nicholas, for having me. And it's a pleasure to talk with you and the Asian Review of Books. I think when it comes to the Long March, I really think it is that pivotal year that really changed modern Chinese history from that point on. Chiang Kai-shek, the year before the Long March, he almost entirely annihilated the communist forces. And in some ways, if he was allowed to sort of follow up with his victories and not fight the Japanese first, then I think China would be a much different country today. So really the Long March was a time in which the communist forces, it was thousands of miles through mountains, quicksand, swamplands. And along the way, they really were allowed to spread their word. Before, communist forces were mostly in the middle southern area of Jiangxi province. And it wasn't until the Long March that villagers all over China got to know what communism was about, that kind of idealistic communism that Mao stood for at that time. The Long March was also this time period that my parents and their parents, so my grandparents, talked about a great deal. I had, some of my wife's grandparents, they participated not in the Long March itself, but they were participating in the direct aftermath of the Long March. And as my parents were talking about it throughout my time growing up, I had a vague idea of what it was about, but I was kind of always in the dark as well. So in some ways, writing this novel was a means for me to kind of get to know China's past, understand the circumstances of the China that my parents knew. And I was born in China, but I immigrated really quickly to the United States at the age of six. And I grew up here. I grew up mostly in Michigan and New York. And even though at school we were learning about U.S. history and world history, at home, my parents were always talking about and referencing Chinese history. And there was that kind of great deal of disconnect as I was growing up. And throughout my teens and early 20s, that, I kind of knew what it was about, but I didn't know what it was about. And it got to a point in my late 20s, when I was getting my PhD at Florida State University, that I was kind of just fed up. I was like, I want to know more about how and why China became the country that it is today. And in a lot of ways, the finger was pointing towards the Long March. So I kind of was just starting there. And it seemed like the more I learned about it, the more I knew about it, the more I felt the Long March was that kind of pivotal point in Chinese history, both in terms of how China became later on and sort of my family's kind of history, connected. So I guess that's sort of why.
Well, let's start talking about the novel and maybe some of the characters in it. So one of the protagonists, you could say, is Yang, who's also one of the book's, I think, most prominent female character. She's a revolutionary. She's a sniper, I believe. Is that correct? And she's one of the few women on the Long March. I wonder if you might talk about kind of what was in your mind when you were creating her character, and also how that reflects the history of the time and the history of women in the CCP in the 30s.
Right. Yang, the Chinese Communist Party did a lot of horrific things to the country, and it put China through decades of just turmoil, and millions of people died from starvation and the Cultural Revolution. But one thing that the CCP did do on some level was gender equality. One of Mao's famous kind of quotes was, men and women were created equally under heaven. I'm kind of butchering that quote, but on some level, men and women saw a greater degree of equality, both in the Communist Party, in the Communist forces of the late 1920s, 1930s. But after 1949, there was female Red Guards. There was a lot of women in the armed forces. A lot of them didn't really do a lot of fighting, but they were in the dance or singing, propaganda kind of tropes. As for Yang as a character, I definitely saw her as that kind of bridge between communist idealistic female versus the sort of traditional female, seen in the late 1800s, early 1900s, pre-Communist Party Chinese women. And, before 1949, a lot of really wealthy men, they were still practicing polygamy. It was very, very common, even in the 1920s, 1930s, for men to have multiple wives. Very famous Chinese, you know, the very famous Chinese writer Lu Xun, he had a wife, you know, that was kind of in the villages, that wasn't educated. They were kind of arranged to be married. And when he studied in Japan, he met another woman there, and then he married again. So it was very common at that time, this type of polygamy, and even more so, a lot of women in prominent kind of households, they were not even given a name, right? So if you have a family who's named Zhang, and their, you know, their surname is Zhang, and they have a lot of daughters, the daughters would not even be named. They would be named second daughter of Zhang, third daughter of Zhang. So, and Yong as a character in the beginning, when she was a young woman, she was kind of married off as the second wife of a kind of wealthy and abusive nobleman. And she saw the communist forces as this kind of escape where people were created not more equally, that kind of idealistic equality of communism, but, you know, we all know it's not true equality. And then from there, she's able to make her own way, to develop her own kind of personality, to be a sort of force in the in the Chinese Communist Army. You do make a really good point, Nicholas, to say that there wasn't a lot of females in the Chinese Army at that time. So in the 1930s, when the Chinese Communist forces were just starting, there was an entire brigade of Chinese female forces. But the way in which I sort of set up in the novel, in which, you know, these kind of female soldiers were interdispersed between the different platoons, that was kind of fabricated, I have to admit. But once they were on the long march themselves, things got so chaotic that you know, it was hard to kind of separate the regiments, and a lot of them were combined into the same kind of unit. So by 1935, 34, you know, what I portray in the novel is truer. But I do feel maybe Yong as a character, I tried my best to make her as realistic as possible at that time.
You know, so the book is kind of organized into kind of five sections, you know, each focusing on a different character. And, you know, perhaps my favorite section of the book is the one that focuses on Haiwu, who's a disabled veteran. He's not ideological. He's very self-pitying. But he's perhaps, you know, the most grounded and caring person in the novel. And I should probably just say for context, this is the part of the novel where Yong and her partner Ping have just had a child, and they're deciding what to do with their child, little Turnip. I just wanted to talk a little about what was in your mind as you were kind of writing that bit of the book, writing Haiwu, the character.
I really appreciate that question, Nicholas, because Haiwu is a character he's rarely asked about in interviews, and which I found kind of disappointing, because Haiwu is one of my favorite characters. I think part three and part five were the two parts that personally I am most proud of, but they're kind of rarely asked in an interview. I see Haiwu as this sort of character that in a lot of ways represents modern Chinese identity, in a sense, like the Chinese identity from the 1920s all the way until, you know, 1970s, 1980s. He is definitely very self-pitying, but he is self-pitying in the sense that after he has finished pitying himself for a couple months or maybe a year or so, he comes back and he laughs off his wounds, and he's kind of reinvigorated, and he's able to continue on. And I think that really represents in some ways the Chinese spirit. I think the Chinese population, they have gone through so many traumatic events in over the span of the last 200 years. You have the Taiping Rebellion, which one of the bloodiest rebellions throughout history. You have upwards of 20 to 30 million people dying from the Taiping Rebellion. And then you have the Chinese Communist Rebellion, and then you have World War II, and then you have the Chinese Civil War finishing up, from 1945 to 1949. And the suffering of the Chinese people are not finished even after that. So throughout the 50s, you have the Great Leap Forward and the massive famine, you saw in 1959 and the early 1960s. And then you would think, okay, that has to be the end of the suffering. But no, in the 60s and in the 70s, you have even greater suffering through the Cultural Revolution. And somehow, in some way, China and its citizens were able to kind of persevere through it. And we remember it, but we also laugh at it in a very similar way as Haiwu. So I kind of find Haiwu's character to be, at least for me, really indicative of this sort of Chinese national identity. And it's really horrific how much suffering they've suffered, but it's also kind of amazing, but also very, very sad that we're able to just soak it up and persevere and in some ways forget about it afterwards. I mean, it also comes down to that kind of old idea of mandate of heaven and Confucianism, and which kind of says that if a government, if a dynasty is no longer providing the people with what they need, they're allowed to rebel, and it's just natural order of things, which I find to be kind of ridiculous, because I mean, that's just how it is in every sort of country. You don't need a mandate of heaven to really, give the citizens that privilege. It's kind of like the citizens, you are allowed to rebel, but it's, I think in China you would call that baihua, right? Or feihua, something like, it's not needed and it's obvious. Anyways, so I think Haiwu for me symbolizes that kind of Chinese national identity and spirit.
Kind of remaining in this particular part of the novel, the pivot in the novel is when Yang and Ping, they have this child, and they have to decide whether to leave Little Turnip behind while they're in almost this kind of random rural Chinese village, which they eventually do. They eventually do decide to leave the child behind and not take Little Turnip with them on the rest of the Long March. Was this a common practice during the Long March? I mean, were there people just kind of left behind in Western China? Or is this a scenario that you kind of thought would be interesting to put in this historical event?
It absolutely did happen while they were on the Long March. I mean, Mao himself, he had a daughter while on the Long March, and he left his daughter, his newborn daughter, in Sichuan province, in a village rough in the similar area as Yang and Ping. In fact, that was kind of the one of the inspirations for the novel, was just knowing that people, while they were on this long march, they were, these soldiers, they were covering anywhere from 10 to 20 kilometers a day. They were, and in really horrific conditions, but they were falling in love, they were having kids, and then they were abandoning they were abandoning their kids wherever they could, wherever they have a local villager that was willing to take them in, because it's very true that at any point where you have a crying baby, then the enemy can easily know your whereabouts, and that just would not, it's carrying a baby while in battle, while fleeing from enemy forces, is just it's just a death sentence for the baby. So that definitely happened. That's definitely true. It happened to Mao. Mao never recovered his daughter, even though he led search parties to Sichuan, where him and other soldiers, they tried to reconnect with the children that they've lost. Some of them did eventually find their lost son or daughter, but very few. Most of them were lost, a large part of that was because in the 1950s. The Sichuan province was devastated by a lot of kind of natural disasters and by the kind of Japanese forces invading into Sichuan. It was really, really hard. There was, the Beggars Guild was something that I also mentioned in part three, and then it becomes like a bigger deal in part four and in part five of the novel. That that was a very much a thing as well. There was beggars guilds in every province, in every major city, and one of the things that they did, unfortunately, was they took in orphans and they amputated limbs, and they did just a lot of kind of horrific things, mutilation of the body, in order for these kids to appear more pathetic on the streets and to be able to beg for more money. So that was a really big deal in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. 90s. I mean, even nowadays, you can occasionally, if you go to popular kind of beggar spots in some of the cities, you'll see people with missing limbs begging. So it's kind of still a thing right now, even. But in terms of whether or not, kids from kids that were born along the long march joining these beggars guilds, I think that was kind of a leap of imagination on my part. Yeah.
So then you said the novel kind of then jumps forward, to the Japanese occupation, then 1978. I guess why did you want to include these kind of skips in time forward?
I think skips in time really helps a novel feel larger, feel that has a grander, broader scope. That's something that I kind of wanted in terms of an initial ambition for the novel. I kind of wanted the novel to be an intergenerational novel. I did think, coming back and revising it and just looking at it now, I did feel almost as if I spent too much time in the first two parts describing the pre-march, the situation and the army and the movement and the battles before the long march actually began. So I was, if I had to write the novel all over again and have a different version of it, that's something that I would definitely think about more, is that kind of balance. As for 1978, what really struck me and made me write about that time period was, one, I think it's another time period in which China underwent dramatic change. Mao died in 1977, and then Deng Xiaoping, he was instated as chairman, and then he brought forth the four modernizations, and then he opened China up to the West. And it was really 1978, after the Gang of Four was captured and executed, that China slowly, slowly at first, and then rapidly developed its economy and became sort of the country that we see it as today. And I think I definitely wanted my novel to cover that part of Chinese history, because I saw it. I see the novel as both like asking this question. The soldiers, the main characters, they lost their son in the novel, but did China lose a sense of itself? You know, on this journey through revolution, on this journey to modernity. And I think that part of the novel really helps kind of bridge the gap between the 1930s and China today. So I think it's also emotionally more impactful to sort of see this kind of turn of fortunes. You know, the entire time Hai Wu was sort of this third wheel. And in some ways, even though Peng and Yong, they have become big shots in the party by part five. Hopefully I'm not spoiling anything. But Hai Wu is kind of more fortunate in other ways. So that kind of reversal of fortune, you know, the entire time, parts one and two, they were both Yong and Ping. They were foreshadowing this idealistic future of what China would become after the revolution has ended. And I think in some ways it's really important to show the difference in how they envision China and how China, you know, what China actually was in the 1970s when the novel ended. So for those reasons, I kind of wanted to kind of transition very rapidly in time in part five.
You know, and I mean, just kind of sticking with those last two sections. I mean, the novel doesn't tie up loose ends. It doesn't tell you what happens to Little Turnip. It doesn't tell you whether the man Yong and Ping meet in part five really is their son. I think there's a heavy implication that he's not. But you know, I potentially saw that as a reflection of just how many how there's still a lot of unknowns, so little documentation, so little information about people who kind of made it through the chaos of Chinese modern history, whether it's the Long March or the occupation or the Cultural Revolution. I mean, how easy or more likely how difficult has it been for people in China to really get answers to some of these questions about what happened to members of their family during these periods of turmoil?
There's a lot of digging that's required and persistence that's required if people really want to know, you know, about their families that has been on the Long March. It was a really, really chaotic time period. I know I've done a fair bit of research for the novel, and I followed a couple of people whose you know descendants kind of searched for their grandparents and to kind of know what their grandparents went through while on the Long March. And it's you know, reading some of the transcriptions from the Chinese to English, it's, you know, a lot of it is just kind of logistical information. Like, we were in this province at this time, from the villagers donated this much flour and this many pounds of, food to us. And then really, really traumatic events like, oh, we crossed this bridge and 400 people died. You know, those were kind of summarized in a couple of sentences. There was not a lot of elaboration from these soldiers who actually knew how to write, and a lot of these they came from letters after the fact. A lot of these also came from the 1960s and 1970s when people were asked kind of personal and political questions, just to because, you know, some of them they were accused of being bourgeois, some of them were accused of being less than Marxist, you know, less than perfect Marxist soldiers, and they were forced to kind of write these pseudo narratives of what they went through. So some of them, they were kind of colored. Some of them were biased. They were not completely accurate. So you have to kind of read between the lines in terms of a lot of these journal entries and these kind of firsthand accounts. But I think the benefits of that is that it allows the writer to fill in the blanks. I think for me, the way in which I do research is I try to, first I have to find the voice of the novel and just the tone, how comedic, how serious, who is the main character and what do they want. Once I've found those type of things, then I would go back and I would try to do as much research as I can. I would read, books upon books on the subject. And my research period would usually last between 1.5 months to 2 months. And afterwards, I would try to sort of forget about the period. I would try to go back to the narrative and just let my imagination, run wild to a certain degree. And of course, there are certain times in my writing process where I would need to, put in brackets, insert good detail or insert period specific detail here. And then I would look up again when I'm revising, those chapters in my novel. But for the most part, I think in some ways, because there's not super exact information on the time period, it kind of gives the writer more leeway to make more details up, to think about the character's motivation, and it just really frees up the writer to do what they do.
So I'd like to kind of ask a question perhaps about you for kind of the last question of the interview. I looked into your bio before this interview. You moved from China to the U.S. as an early age. Both this and your previous book are kind of set in these chaotic periods of Chinese history. And I guess, what has it been like to kind of return to these settings in your fiction? I think especially as the current relationship between the U.S. and China seems to be going through a down patch at the moment, to put it lightly.
Yeah. It is really harrowing a lot of times when I'm writing about these subject matters, especially when the subject matters are close to my family's background. It's more for my story collection, Further News of Defeat, than it was for Lost in a Long March. Many parts of Further News of Defeat, many stories in that collection, they dealt with experiences that my great-grandparent went through. The title story in that collection, it was about the Japanese occupation of a local village. And basically, the Japanese, they came to this local village in Shaanxi province, and they kind of took away some of the young men to go and work in a local coal mine. And then the rest of the village, after they were, after a couple of weeks, after they were done, stripping the village of the local kind of labor force, they forced all of the people into the town square, and then they threw them into the well. That was loosely based off of my grandmother's experience. Her grandfather was the village chief at the time, and when the Japanese came, he went up to a large hill to kind of greet them, and they just shot him on the spot. In a lot of ways, I feel, early on, I questioned whether or not I'm even allowed to write this. I've kind of lived a relatively cushy life in the United States, been given kind of great privilege to pursue an education to study writing. It took a lot of debate in my mind, just am I even allowed to kind of write about this stuff? But on another part, on another level, it's, you know, like, if I don't write about this stuff, who will? This is my family's kind of story after all. My grandmother, she is illiterate in Chinese. She passed this down orally, and it's, I'm pretty sure there's no other writer, at least in the village that she grew up in, which is a neighboring village than the village that my father was born and grew up in. So, going back to these experiences, it's difficult, but and I feel almost as if I shouldn't kind of exploit these experiences, but if I don't, then who else will write about these situations as well? Who will remember these situations? So it's always a difficult process. My next couple of books, they're gonna, you know, I've planned out my next two novels. They're gonna be a little bit different. They're still gonna have a historical vein, some of them, but they're not going to be as centered around realism as my story collection or my novel.
Well, that's kind of preemptive. The actual last question I ask as we close off the interview. First of all, thank you again, Michael, for joining us on the Review Books podcast to talk about Lost in the Long March. You know, again, to kind of ask the actual last question, which is, where can people find your work? And if you could talk a bit about your next project.
Yeah, absolutely. You guys can buy my novel, Lost in the Long March, from Abrams Books, their website, wherever you prefer to buy your books. My story collection was published by Autumn House Press. You can purchase it through their website or just any place that you would like to buy your books. I have just finished a draft of my second novel. It's titled The Red Synthetic Utopia of the Mind, and I know that's a mouthful, and maybe it's going to be changed when it comes out, if it comes out. But it kind of deals with immigration, video games, and there's an element of kind of dystopia as well. The main character, her name is Harriet Chu, and she's immigrated to the United States on a video game visa. She's playtesting this artificial intelligence, and she merges her minds with the AI, and the AI kind of changes the world into one where China and the United States, their places switch. So, the U.S. has kind of become this third world country, and China has become this this first world sort of power, and then chaos ensues. So that's my second novel. My third novel, which I'm still in the planning stages, but it's called Jeff Bezos is the First Emperor of China. And basically in this novel, this is maybe 30 years in the future. Jeff Bezos, he is a very old man. Amazon has become this even more powerful corporation, and they're selling goods all over the world. Bezos, he has like research facilities all over the world, and he has discovered time travel. And he also has discovered the ability to change races. So he makes himself Asian first, and then he goes back in time to the first dynasty, to the Qin dynasty, thousands of years ago. And because it's there's this kind of Chinese kind of fable rumor that the first emperor was searching for the elixir of immortality, And so Jeff Bezos goes back in time. He finds the elixir immortality. He makes himself young again, but he's still Chinese. And he becomes the first emperor of China. And using all of his bureaucratic skills that he's learned from, you know, running and building Amazon, he runs the he starts the corrupt bureaucratic system, you know, in Chinese history. So that is the idea for my third novel. Thank you so much, Nicholas, for allowing me to talk about my next two books.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find countless other off interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. We're on all our favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us continuing to interview those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Professor John D. Wong, author of Hong Kong Takes Flight, Commercial Aviation and the Making of a Global Hub, 1930s to 1998. But before then, Michael, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Nicholas, for having me.